In this video, I will talk about how do we view bullying, and I introduce four lenses. This can be considered as frameworks or theories, although I think that these already include different types of theories, but they are more like lenses how we view bullying. And this influences, for instance, how do we start targeting? What do we think that we need to stop bullying? And for instance, these lenses can influence what kind of attitude we have towards bullying, and how do we, for instance, comfort victims when bullying happens. And very typical sayings are that boys are boys, or you just have to survive, that shouldn't be too weak. Or we may say that these bullies have the problem, so don't worry, it's not about you. They have a low self-esteem and they are actually suffering. Or in many actually teacher trainings, I've heard this, that it's the parents who we would need to train or educate. That we do a lot in school, but all the bad behavior come actually from the home environments. Or parents in turn may say that, yes, no, my child is not really bullying, behaving very nicely at home, so there is something wrong in the interpretation or something. Or we may guide our children to say that, yeah, you don't really need to be friend with everybody, which is very difficult what we say, but actually does this continue to remain this kind of social exclusion idea in our society? But let's go to the four lenses. The first lens I have labeled as individual psychology lens. And as we can see that we have really clearly individual features here, such as personality, temperament, intelligence, that we can find different kind of risk, we can consider them as risk factors or protective factors against bullying or victimization. Learning disabilities, social skill deficits can be labeled as such individual risk factors. Of course, even if I say that it's individual psychology, I do not neglect the idea that we also put the relationship factors here, but still the idea that we are targeting individuals to change the individual to reduce bullying or make the victim feel better and so on. So also the individual social cognitive processes, which are, for instance, the theories that have to do with social information processing or theory of mind, which have to do with how we interpret social information, which is, for instance, related with aggressive behavior. So if we interpret easily other person's act as negative or somehow threatening us, then we easily aggress towards that person, even if that interpretation is eventually wrong. And theory of mind in turn has to do with perspective taking skills. So can we actually go to the other person's mind and know and understand how she or he is feeling? And these have been extensively studied in relation to aggression and bullying behaviors. And then I also have put the family risk and protective factors here, for instance, attachment theory or social learning theories, although of course they're happening in relationship. But when the child comes to school, she is considered as bearing these things what they have internalized from home or learned from home, so they come with that behavior to school. And then again, we have the individual student to be changed, or we need to teach him or her new things, how to behave. So targeting individuals is the individual psychology lens idea. Another lens that I want to introduce you is the evolutionary lens or evolutionary perspective to bullying. And this is very appealing. I really like the idea how it's been studied, and a lot of evidence is found supporting the evolutionary theories on bullying. So I really hope that you will be able to use the evolutionary lens as well. And with this lens, we think that behaviors are adaptation to environments. And instead of viewing bullying something maladaptive, deficits or something that the bully is suffering from, it's actually adaptive behavior, strategic behavior, goal-oriented behavior. to gain something. And from the evolutionary perspective, we want to, of course, survive in the environments when we need to. We need to gain resources, food, and other things, and of course, reproductive success is one of the bases there. So this is very important lens because this changes our view of bullying from being something maladaptive towards something that children use in order to gain something, which makes it more complex and it's more difficult to stop because they are still gaining the rewards, what they need to gain the resources or social dominance in the group. And this is, for instance, this author's Volk and colleagues state clearly that this is probably why zero tolerance policies are quite useless. So if we merely say to children that, okay, we do not accept bullying, it should not happen, this is bad, why would they stop if they gain what they want in the peer group? The third lens is socio-ecological lens, and this is very important, and this is especially important when we think about the whole school approaches on bullying prevention. So this approach comes from Bronfenbrenner, which is very familiar probably for all of you. The idea that individuals are embedded in different contexts. We have our family context, then we have the school class context. We are embedded always in relationships. And then there is the communities that we are involved, and then of course the whole society. And these contexts are mutually influencing each other. And when we think about bullying prevention, we do not only try to prevent the individual, but the individual in the context. And as we know from plenty of research, the context can moderate how individuals are behaving or feeling in different contexts. So we also aim to change the contexts, modify the contexts. So for instance, I have a kind of risk factors towards bullying. So I have a very strong desire for dominance, and I'm in one classroom in which I can, with my bullying behavior, I can gain the dominance, I can gain power. I will use bullying to gain gain status in the group. But in another group where there is a really clear anti-bullying policies and other children are looking bad if I start behaving aggressively or excluding someone, that's not very good strategy to gain power. So now I actually already mixed the evolutionary lens and socio-ecological framework to thinking about how different contexts can modify my evolutionary tendency to bully. So both lenses are needed when we think about bullying prevention. There is a fourth lens, which I'm still self a bit insecure, but this is sociocultural lens. And in recent years, I've been studying about it and trying to understand this lens better. It originates originally from Vygotsky, and it's very similar to this socio-ecological lens, thinking that we are embedded in the context and the context is influencing us and we can influence the context. But it's also thinking that this, we even going so far that we never can define bullying similarly in different contexts. So the context actually can change our understanding of the phenomenon. And yes, when we think about the cultural differences or cultural influences, how we see bullying, this can be important lens to consider. But this is also a kind of saying against my idea that we need to define bullying. It's also saying a kind of that we cannot never define it completely. It's too complex phenomenon to be defined and operationalized, and also a bit against the definite measures. But a very good thing from this perspective is that we would perhaps need to put more attention to changing the systems power hierarchies in the society, think about more deep our cultural ways of thinking than merely the individuals or even the simple context that we typically look about. So overall, I think that we do need to understand the different kinds of contexts that bullying takes place. We need to take into account the individual psychological lens, but it's very important that we understand that bullying is a relational phenomenon, which happens usually in group, and also we are influenced by our communities and the whole society. So thinking about where to address, so all of these to address, then we probably get better results. So now I have introduced all the lens and a bit already given an idea of the contents of them, and I will give a few ideas about the mechanisms of bullying that are related to these different lenses. So mechanisms of bullying. There are already decades of studies that have made us better understand on what is really, who are the children who bully others. They are not completely homogeneous group. And an important finding was that they are not definitely, and or at least not only, the children who are reactively aggressive, but they are actually quite strategic and goal-oriented children who want to gain something in the peer group. And these different studies, for instance, finding that social intelligence is not negatively related with indirect aggression or bullying, but actually children who bully, they can be socially intelligent. And important thing is that we have found that they are perceived as popular. So children who bully, they tend to be popular in the peer group. And they're not necessarily liked. So we know from studies that being liking and popularity are two different things. And that those who bully, they tend to be popular, not necessarily liked. And they have this desire also. Bullying often happens when there is audience present. So, which again, a kind of supports the idea that of evolutionary ideas that it's about gaining status and power. I need audience to demonstrate my power. And we also know from some studies that bullying is selective. So when someone starts bullying, it's wise to select targets who are easy, who cannot defend themselves. A kind of already embedded in the definition of bullying. So we can see that in the past 30 years, we have got a better idea of bullying, and what makes it complex is because it's not only a problem behavior, but it's actually adaptive behavior for the children. And these are several studies that have shown that bullies have a desire for status. They are often popular in the peer group. They have central position. And we even know from longitudinal studies that bullying can increase status in the peer group and maintain it over time. So it makes sense to bully if you are interested in peer status or dominance. And we also know from, it's very interesting studies from Carando and colleagues, she found that in classrooms which have very strong hierarchies, that there are very popular students and very low popular students, in these classrooms bullying tends to be more frequent. So again, a kind of demonstration that bullying is really related to status hierarchies. And we could of course think that when there is established status hierarchy, that there would be more harmony, but at least in the studies that we have at the moment in hands, say that status hierarchy is not a good thing. So thinking about the competitive culture or competitive classrooms or academic world, I would say that when we think about bullying, we should probably be careful about those and more try to create demographic environments where children can be equal to each other. Yes. Norms are often studied with bullying, and this is related to this, how you say, sociocultural lens in a way that we know that even if we have children who have negative attitudes against bullying, which typically is the case, bullying still happens in the classroom. And we know that the attitude is only moderately related with these behaviors, but there is more room, more even effects from the effect from the context. So for instance, group norms can influence how much bullying is happening in the group, whether it's accepted or not. So the idea that we can influence attitudes, but that's certainly not enough. We need to influence the context. And one pioneer or very important research, at least in the Finnish Kiva Anti-Bullying program, but also widely used in internationally, is the participant role approach, in which Salmi Valli found already in the 90s in her dissertation that in the classroom we can find different roles. So not only victims and bullies, but we can see that some children in the classroom tend to support the bullies. They may assist them, or they may in one way or another reinforce the bully's behavior by laughing or giving their support to the bully. And this is exactly the way how bullies will gain the feeling that I'm powerful, I'm popular, and I'm listened to, when they have these followers who support them. Luckily, we have children who are against bullying, and they actively defend the victims, which is really good. But then a kind of most or majority of children tend to stay outside. And in Finnish, we have the word silent approving or silent approval for this, because the victims often case feel that these children, the outsiders, they accept it, although they would actually think that it's not correct behavior and they don't like it, but the victim feels so. They say, start feeling that everybody is against me. Understanding the bullying roles can be very important thought-provoking for adolescents and children at how they behave in the different situation. What I want to always highlight when I'm speaking about the bullying roles, that let's be cautious in labeling children as bullies or victims or defenders or reinforcers, because these are labels that easily stick. And we want to understand these as fluid behaviors that can change. And we know well that although there is some permanency in the roles, we also know that they can change. And one child can bully in one occasion or one context, but he or she can also defend someone else in another context. So they are not definite. So preferably using that the child is bullying or hurting someone, or the child is victimized in this situation, but not trying to avoid making them as labeling them as such. Important in this understanding these group roles and the norms in the group is that we know that such kind of bullying climate does influence whether the bullying happens or not. So for instance, we know that a child who is anxious or rejected in the room, in the classroom, they are usually the so-called easy targets for the bullies. So if a child is rejected by most of the, it's not liked by most of classmates, then of course the bully has then, it's easy to start bullying because he will or she will get support from the classmates. But we know that this doesn't happen in every classroom. So such risk factors do not realize in all kinds of contexts. And if we have a lot of children who reinforce bullying, who are supporting the bully, we know that anxious child or rejected child very likely becomes victimized in that classroom. But in the classrooms that we have a lot of defenders, we know that such children are not victimized at all necessarily. So we do not need to change the child who is shy to become less shy, or try to change the anxiety, but we need to change the context where they are in and make them feel accepted in that group. We also know that it's not only, of course, the peers. Of course, peers are probably the most influential in the classroom, but especially in the lower grades, teachers have a lot of power. We know that teachers' anti-bullying attitudes can moderate the frequency of victimization. So if children perceive that their teacher is against bullying, giving anti-bullying lessons and talking about it and really showing the attitudes out, we know that victimization happens less often in those classrooms. We also know that teacher self-efficacy is important. So when we have strong anti-bullying rules in the classroom and teacher feels that he's efficacious, that does matter. And there is very interesting study from Guimantet and colleagues. This was a genetically informed twin study in which they were studying about children who had genetic risk for anxiety. So I'm inclined to get anxious because of my genes. And if they got victimized by peers, it's very likely that they become anxious indeed. So that's quite natural. So that's already one important result. So if they are victimized, but this risk to become anxious, even if victimized, didn't realize when their teachers had high self-efficacy beliefs of handling bullying, or when there was a strong anti-bullying rules in their classroom. So basically, this means that even if teacher cannot put stop in bullying, bullying can still happen. He or she can do more, or classroom can have a lot of effect on how the consequences are realized. So even if I'm victimized in the classroom, the negative consequences may not be that bad if the context is otherwise supportive and I can see that the teacher has capabilities. Of course, when we still go further in this socio-ecological idea of bullying, we need to look at also school level factors and beyond the demographic factors, for instance, school size and immigrant status and so on. We have a lot of things in the climate aspects that is related to bullying and victimization, which is quite natural. Not too many studies in it, but for instance, one study found that when school has very strong policies against violence, we can see that there is less victimization. Also, student participation has been found to be related to less violence in schools. I think there was also a Finnish study recently who found the same thing, that because we try to enhance student participation, and I think we should also enhance student participation specifically in anti-bullying effort, so that is related to less frequent victimization. Teacher supportive relationship as well. And these things are also raised in a student, more qualitative studies in the student experiences. So that we really need to put emphasis on the whole school climate as well. So this was about the socio-ecological lens, but then let's go a bit back to the, not the individual level, but relationship level. And we know well that having defenders is important. We saw already that the teacher's behavior matters, but it's very important that even if the child is bullied, he or she would have defenders in the classroom. And this is actually as important than the efforts of putting stop to bullying, so that we could create a safe relationship for the victimized students if we cannot stop the bullying completely. We know that from the former victims' interviews in Terasahjo and Salmivalli already a long time ago, but we also hear this often in media, that it was really important that there were some people who cared about me. So the worst thing here was that no one cared. Important thing that I tend to always remind is the Martin Luther King's statement. The ultimate strategy is not the oppression and cruelty by the bad people, but the silence over that by the good people. And I think the silent approving comes from this saying, that we need to recruit those people who are not self trying to gain power in the group, but the other people not to give that power to those people who are desiring it. So thinking about bullying prevention, again, we need to influence all children in the classroom, not only the bullies who are gaining what they want by their bad behavior. How then we can explain the silence? As we know that most children are against bullying if we ask them. Most children think that this is wrong, but still they either they even participate or they may just remain outsiders. And we know that there is this cognitive dissonance. So how come those children can handle this situation? One direction of research is moral disengagement. It's a kind of mechanisms that, as here is stated, that mechanisms that permit people to disengage from moral standards without feeling of remorse, guilt, and self-condemnations. So basically a way to justify one's behavior or way to explain myself that I do it and then try to relieve my own stress levels because I'm doing against what I generally think that is not correct. And we know from research that those who bully others, they tend to have used this kind of moral disengagement more often, especially moral justification, which would be, for instance, say that I was protecting my friends or some other ways justifying that why I did that and that. Or they may often attribute this to the victim, that dehumanizing or blaming the victim by saying, for instance, that it was their own fault, the victim is so weird, he's behaving self badly, so again making blaming the victim about the bullying. And we all, on the other hand, we know that defenders, for instance, they are not using this kind of moral disengagement, so they are kind of taking the responsibility of the situation without trying to explain it or justify it. And for instance, we know that they are not blaming the victim so often, and they are not trying to kind of minimize their own role. So, which again, the opposite is that they take the responsibility. And yes, and I would think that this kind of minimizing one's role can be that everybody else is doing it, or no one else is defending. Or for instance, when I was a child and the boys in the classroom were bullying each other a lot, there was a lot of going on. I never intervened, and I even never told the teacher, because I kind of thought that it's the boys and it's not my business, not my responsibility. But we know that there are also nice studies about defending behavior, which is of course that we try to encourage children to do. A good thing is that perceived popularity is related to defending, and not only in the way that popular children have the courage to defend, but actually we know that over time, if children defend, they can become more popular. Of course, defending needs self-efficacy, so we need to teach them tools to defend, think of ways of defense safely, and of course encourage defending in overall. We also need to raise empathy, because we know that of course empathy is related to defending. When we feel that other people is suffering, we want to help them. There is also interesting distinction between affective and cognitive empathy. So defending behavior needs affective empathy, the feeling that someone is suffering. But actually, those who bully others, they can be cognitively empathetic, so a kind of going to this theory of mind or perspective taking, and they are pretty skilled in understanding what other person is feeling, but they do not necessarily feel it so deeply in there. So they still know how other person is feeling. We know from also that context, of course, influence defending behavior as well. And if there are a lot of bullies who are highly popular, it's less likely that a child will defend, even if they were popular or they had high self-efficacy. But important is also that the teacher would encourage defending and be really strongly against bullying because that also influences children's defending behavior. So overall, a long talk about different lenses, that we need to put different lenses to understand that bullying is a very complex phenomenon. We need all of the lenses to help children to learn different strategies against bullying. We need to understand how the context is influencing, not merely blaming the families or not merely trying to change the individuals, because changing doesn't make sense if the child is still gaining something. So changing the school environments, having strong anti-bullying policies, increasing the safety overall so that you wouldn't need to fight your place or be too a kind of trying to be in the dominance position to gain resources or the scarce resources that are easily competed in a non-safe environment. We need to train teachers to be more self-efficacy, to really show their attitudes towards their children that they are against bullying. And of course, the warm and good relationship with students is highly important, which we easily know. But important and very important is influencing classrooms, their climate, trying to make children understand each and everyone's responsibility against bullying, try to change the norms towards more anti-bullying, more anti-bullying norms, and overall increase the psychological safety. And I think the hierarchies is a very important thing to keep in mind, that we aim to have classrooms with fewer hierarchies, which of course we can try to do by making children to take contact with each other, having different kind of groupings so that they wouldn't be clicking in small groups, and making sure that we avoid competition in the classroom. But of course, we shouldn't forget the individuals, that we still do need to encourage them to defend and take responsibility, and try to, of course, still influence the attitudes and try to make them think about bullying differently.